From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. During World War II, a specially selected unit of men known as the Ghost Army carried out a series of elaborate deceptions aimed at tricking the German army into making strategic mistakes and helping Allied forces win the war. The group of architects, artists, audio experts, and other creative thinkers are credited with saving tens of thousands of lives, yet their efforts in the war remained a secret for decades. The Ghost Army will be honored later this month by the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida. Plus, civil liberties advocates say Florida policies for restoring rights to former felons are among the most restrictive in the nation. We'll explore the history of laws that prohibit rights like voting to felons, how Florida law compares to other states, and what may come from a recent compliance review of U.S. policies by the United Nations Committee on Human Rights. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. For the rest of the hour, we'll be taking a look at Florida law when it comes to restoring civil rights to former felons. In February, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder singled out Florida in a statement urging states to repeal laws that prohibit the restoration of civil rights like voting from former felony offenders. Pointing to the backlog of former felons waiting to have their cases heard by the Florida Clemency Board, civil liberties advocates say the Sunshine State's policies on restoring rights to ex-felons are the most restrictive in the nation and that they're a barrier to reducing recidivism rates. Proponents of Florida's current policy point to the seriousness of some felony offenses and argue that ex-felons should have to live crime-free for a period of time before asking to have their rights restored. Joining me now for a closer look at the history and impact of voting restrictions on former felons is Mark Maurer. He's executive director of the D.C.-based nonprofit The Sentencing Project, which advocates for fair and effective policies in the U.S. criminal justice system. He's the author of the book Race to Incarcerate, which explores the history behind the growth in American prison populations and has been an advocate for criminal justice policy reforms for more than three decades. Mark, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
We invited State Attorney General Pam Bondi or a representative of her office to join the conversation as well this morning, but they declined. But I do invite our listeners to join us. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Mark, first off, help us understand the history behind laws that prohibit former felons from voting, not just in Florida, but around the nation. These really gained heavy traction in the years following the Civil War, correct?
Well, that's true. I mean, in some cases, they go back to the time of the founding of the country. In a number of states after the Civil War, often with a very specific intent of excluding the newly freed black male voters, some of the southern states adopted disenfranchisement policies that specifically targeted these voters. You had states like Alabama and South Carolina, for example, tweak their laws so that if you're convicted of beating your wife, you'd lose your right to vote, but if you were convicted of killing your wife, you would not lose the right to vote. And somehow that was based on the racial logic of the time and how certain people would be excluded. And this came about the same time as poll taxes, literacy requirements in many states, you know, with a very specific racial intent at the moment then.
Well, and those laws were largely, you know, the Jim Crow laws largely struck down by the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But when it comes to restoration of civil rights for felony offenders, it looks like there's still a lot of work to do. Just giving us a better understanding of Florida policy when it comes to the restoration of civil rights. In 2006, more than 14,000 former felons had their rights restored in Florida under Governor Jeb Bush. In 2008, that number was up to 85,000. But then in 2011, once the Scott administration was in office, that number slowed to just 78 people. What happened in Florida over the past decade?
Well, Florida is one of just four states, along with Virginia, Kentucky, and Iowa, where every felony conviction results in a lifetime loss of voting rights, unless you can get the governor or a pardon board to restore your rights. So that means that, you know, you could be an 18-year-old with a first-time felony drug possession conviction. You may never vote again. In Florida, the regulations that pertain to restoration of rights through the governor can be tweaked and have been by successive governors over the last several decades. And so how burdensome or not the process is in large part determines what happens. We saw several years ago when Governor Crist came into office, he opened up the process quite substantially. Essentially, if you're convicted of a nonviolent offense, it would be almost an automatic rights restoration, assuming you hadn't been rearrested since you'd been out. When Governor Scott came into office, he immediately changed that policy, and essentially everybody had to go back to square one. And square one basically means there's a lengthy waiting period before you can even get your case heard. Very few cases are being processed. There's no reason to believe the kind of cases that are in the pipeline are any different than, say, the 85,000 who had their rights restored just a few years ago, but just the new administration's policy has really just closed off the spigot almost entirely.
And there's a waiting period in Florida of 5 to 7 years for an ex-felon, you know, and this is after completion of sentence, parole, or any necessary restitution paid before they are even qualified to request a hearing before the clemency board. Attorney General Pam Bondi here defended that waiting period, citing the seriousness of some felony offenses and arguing that people should have to live crime-free for a period of time before having their rights restored or having that considered. In one statement, Bondi had said, quote, committing a felony is a serious breach of the bonds that join us together as a society, end quote. How do you respond to that point?
Well, you know, people commit serious crimes in all states, and that's why we have criminal punishments that sometimes involve prison, sometimes probation and other things. But I think we have to be very careful when we confuse legitimate punishment objectives of the justice system with your fundamental rights as a citizen. You know, even if you're sitting in a prison cell in maximum security prison, you still have the right to get married or divorced, to buy or sell property and the like. So conditioning your voting rights when you get out of prison on your behavior, you know, almost looks like we're imposing a character test of some sort. And, you know, we really, in a democracy, I think that's a very harmful thing to do. It also, I think, conflicts with our collective goals for public safety. If you think of people coming out of prison, we know there are high rates of recidivism in general. The best way to counter that is to get former prisoners connected with positive institutions in the community. So we want them to get jobs, we want them to have a good place to live, have a good social network. People who participate in the electoral process, this is an indication of engagement with, commitment with the community. If the message we send to people is that, yes, you're living in the community, you're expected to go abide by laws and regulations of society, but by the way, you're still a second-class citizen, I think that's not a very smart way to go about doing things. It can help, but make people feel as an outsider. It doesn't mean they're going to go out and commit crimes as a result, but it certainly doesn't enhance that reintegration process.
And one thing I hear from, you know, civil rights advocates is that, you know, restoring civil rights like voting actually does help reduce recidivism rates. Is there research, is there data to back that up?
There's only limited research. The best study is one that was done in Minnesota looking at rearrest prospects and people who had convictions or not in voting issues. And that study suggests that voting combined with other actions that are engaging people in the community can result in lower rates of rearrest. And the researchers are very sophisticated, and they recognize that, you know, the motivation to vote may be related to other positive connections as well, but they find that even taking that into account, they think the electoral process, the engagement, does make a difference, does contribute to public safety.
And I had been looking to bring on a gentleman named Desmond Mead, who is a former felon himself, and he is about to finish law school here. He made a testimony before that UN Human Rights Committee last week that I'd mentioned earlier in the show as a delegate for the NAACP. And he highlighted that if he were an ex-felon who had completed all his stipulations of his sentence today, he would have to wait until 2021 just to apply to have his rights restored before the Executive Clemency Board, and that even then the average wait time for someone to have their application seen before the board is going to be another 6 years. So that brings us up to the year 2027. How does that compare to other states that also do not automatically restore ex-felons' civil rights? Do they have those kind of backlogs?
Some of them have backlogs. As I mentioned, in addition to the four states, that including Florida, disenfranchise all, the other states that do it, seven or eight additional ones, do it in more moderate ways. So sometimes if you have a single felony conviction, you can get your rights restored, but if you have two felony convictions, you can't, or sometimes it's dependent on the particular crime. Much of the problem we see as well has to do with just the process itself. You know, in several states, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people disenfranchised, and yet very few people know about the process. The executive office doesn't have enough people to process the applications very readily. It's hard to get information. I think it all points to sort of the inefficiency of this whole process. You know, if you think of a state like Florida, whether or not they're processing the applications, merely just gathering them in and sorting them, all that, it's an enormous amount of time administratively to deal with something that in two-thirds of the states would be an automatic process. You'd never even have to look at this. So from all accounts, certainly the person trying to get voting rights restored, but even from the point of view of state efficiency, you know, this is a very antiquated process, I think not terribly helpful.
Mm-hmm. And more than 1.5 million of the 5.85 million former felons who haven't had their voting rights restored live in Florida. That's a pretty disproportionate number. Would you say that there's any state that compares to Florida in terms of its restrictions?
Well, Florida, yeah, does lead the nation in numbers, in part because of its overall population, but in large part because of, you know, what its policies look like. Other states, you know, that have very high rates of disenfranchisement, Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, are not far below Florida, at least in a proportional basis. All of these states also have very high, very disproportionate rate for African-American disenfranchisement. And what we've seen is that with the growth of the criminal justice system over the last four decades, you know, we have a world record prison population. Along that, with that has come record rates of disenfranchisement. So for African Americans, three states, Virginia, Florida, Kentucky, an estimated one of every five African Americans is disenfranchised from voting, almost all of them, the vast majority, because of previous felony convictions, which they've completed their serving their sentence, but because of the policies in those states, are still barred from voting.
And we're talking about a demographic here which, you know, not to speak too much in generalizations, but tends to vote Democratic. Is there a political motivation behind Florida's policies?
Well, one would hope not. I mean, certainly it, you know, the laws themselves go back, you know, a long ways. At some points, I think there's a clear racist intent. Lawmakers today would argue there's nothing intentional about this. You know, it's hard to know what goes on behind closed doors and how different parties view these issues. It seems to me it would be very unseemly on either side of the issue to take that into account. You know, if we think of, you know, the women's suffrage movement and 100 years ago gaining the right to vote, I don't think there was a lot of discussion about which party women would vote for. The issue was just one of fairness and justice and what kind of democratic society would we want. So I think we should approach the issue on that basis, and then partisans of all parties should get out the vote and try to convince people to support them. But we would hope that this does not become a partisan issue.
And final question for you, Mark. You know, with this UN Committee on Human Rights review of U.S. compliance with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, ACLU of Florida testified there. Desmond Mead, as I mentioned, also testified. Can whatever comes out of that committee really have any influence over Florida law going forward?
Well, it doesn't have a direct influence, but I think, you know, international body of opinion on our criminal justice policies broadly, you know, the outlier status of the U.S. in terms of our use of incarceration, our use of the death penalty, and also disenfranchisement. The United States is really at one extreme among democratic nations. And I think it contributes to the climate for reconsideration of these policies. We're seeing even now states like Kentucky, legislation moving through there that has strong support from the Black caucus in the legislature, but also strong support from Senator Rand Paul.
And Mark, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We are coming to a close, but thank you so much, Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for having me.
More information on today's show, as well as an archive of past shows, is available on our website. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM.